Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First one in the list is eBTables. And eBTables, what does that stand for? I don't know what it stands for, but what it is I think Ethernet Bridge. That must be what it stands for, actually. Ethernet Bridge Tables, something like that. But it is IP tables for a bridge interface. You'll recall that we spoke about bridge interfaces not too long ago. We set up a bridge and connected an interface to it and so on. And that's the thing, that's kind of the virtual interface that a lot of times your virtual machine would talk to. Well, if it's a virtual interface, sending packets through it, even though it's just pretend, surely we could apply essentially a firewall to that interface, right? Well, yeah, you can. It's with eBTables. If you go to ebtables.netfilter.org, the documentation's fantastic, but if you're already familiar with IP tables, then you almost don't need the document. I mean, you do, but I mean, you'll look at it and you'll think, oh my gosh, this is IP tables, except for a bridge. And you make declarations like ebtables-p /drop, ebtables-a /p IPv4-j, except, as I said, it's IP tables, except for a bridge. So it is the same everything, same principle, except instead of a firewall at your actual physical network interface, like whether it's your Wi-Fi card or your Ethernet port, whatever, it's a firewall at this pretend imaginary virtual Ethernet device. Now, lest I give you the impression that I take IP tables, or EB tables for that matter, casually, make no mistake, I don't know IP tables, I don't like IP tables, I don't want to deal with IP tables. I much prefer firewall CMD, firewall command, the front end for firewall D. I think it's a much more sort of realistic way to configure a firewall, to be honest. It's a lot easier, and I do understand that IP tables gives you a lot of very, very direct control over a lot. I mean, every aspect of packets, pretty much, you can filter out through IP tables. So I don't discount IP tables' usefulness. I simply admit that on a day-to-day basis, if I'm managing a software firewall, more often than not, I'm going to do it with firewall CMD rather than messing around with raw IP tables. So I'm not saying, oh, this is just like IP tables and everybody knows IP tables, because I don't believe that everyone does know IP tables, myself included. I have to look stuff up for IP tables and do a lot of testing, and this just takes forever, and I don't love it. That said, EB tables, you know, if you learn IP tables, then you basically know EB tables. There's not a whole lot of a difference. So that's kind of refreshing, I guess. Elm is next up in the list, and Elm is an email client, which means that, you know, this isn't what it means, but there is construction outside my window right now. So if you're hearing a lot of noise, hammering and digging and things like that, that's just background noise. Bear with me. Okay, so Elm being an email client, that means that it's the application you use to read and write email. The way email gets into Elm and how it gets out of Elm when you click send, or not click, but when you press the key for sending an email, all of that stuff, that isn't Elm. Elm just does the reading and the writing of emails. It does storage and things like that too. You know, it's copying stuff from some spool, or for some, probably more likely, from a server through over POP3 or even more likely these days, IMAP, and it stores things locally and that kind of thing. But it is just the client. And I find that this kind of discussion can get very complex and confusing very quickly if you don't really separate out all the different functions, because that's what the software is doing. I mean, that's what the software typically does. I mean, a lot of the software that we're using for email now, I think a lot of people are just kind of using some thing on some service, and who the heck knows how email gets in and out, and what the where the client starts and where the client ends. I mean, somebody does. Back-end developers, front-end developers, they know. But a lot of us, we don't know. So Elm is a piece of the puzzle. And before Elm, there's something that you're using to go get email from a server. And after Elm, there's something you're using to send email to a server. So that means you need to know how to log into that server to retrieve the messages. You need to know how to log in to send the messages and what the address for the sending is and all that other stuff. Elm isn't going to figure that out for you. So you need to configure that, of course. So your first experience with Elm would be probably that you would launch Elm, and then you'll be prompted to have a .elm subdirectory created in your home directory. You would probably say yes to that, and I think then it asks to create a mail directory as well, which, again, you'd probably have to say yes to that, unless you want to go through a whole thing of configuring where your local mail gets stored and so on. I believe Elm uses the inbox format, I think. Sounds right from the man page. I'm just not looking at it right now. Either way, you need a little bit of infrastructure. It's mostly hidden from you. Like the .elm directory has, that's the default location for your .elmrc, your configuration file. And the configuration file, strangely, is not configured for you. You're not prompted to create it. There really isn't a whole lot of guidance on when that should happen. So you launch Elm, and that's it. I think Elm technically assumes, like a lot of these old email applications did, that your email is tied to your workstation at the default, with the domain of whatever your network says your domain is. Now, in the modern world, that's just not how things work. Nobody's doing that. You don't email somebody literally at their computer. You email it to some service somewhere that runs a bunch of email accounts. So this is not the default, probably, for Elm, unless you're using Elm for just literally local use. You work at a production some kind of place that has a bunch of Unix, Linux workstations, and you email each other just locally. Never, your emails don't go out to the internet to reach you. They just float around your network. That's a valid way of doing things. Even in the location, the main place that I worked where there was such a system, like a true multi-user Unix system in place, that we didn't do it that way. We still used, the big internet for email. So I just don't know how realistic that scenario is. More likely you're configuring it for something. I don't know what it would be. Let's say it was Gmail, although you would be better off using Forward Mail or even Proton or something, but let's just assume for a moment it's Gmail, because it's kind of an easy baseline to set here. So you'd create this .elmrc file and define your inbox, or rather the location of your services inbox. So that's just inbox colon, and I like to quote things. So quote imap dot, for instance, gmail.com/ssl, more on that in a moment, /user equals, and then whatever your email address is, example@gmail.com, close quote. Okay, so that's the elmrc file. It's just telling Elm that the inbox that Elm believes it's going to use isn't the inbox that you want it to use. You've reset or redefined your inbox from Elm's default to this funky IMAP location using SSL, which Elm doesn't support. Elm doesn't do SSL. However, there's a program you can use called S-Tunnel, which What is, where is S-Tunnel? Is it in a package called, have we talked about S-Tunnel yet? I don't even know. Var log packages, iname, quote, S-Tunnel? Yeah, okay, so it's a tunnel, S-Tunnel is a package. If we haven't talked about it, I'm pretty confident we will talk about it soon. In fact, I should talk about it now, and then not talk about it later, but let's see if I remember that we've talked about S-Tunnel. So S-Tunnel is, it's an SSL tunnel that you can use to help an application that doesn't know how to do SSL through this tunnel. So in this case, you would create a .stunnel directory in your home directory and create a file in that called imap.conf. So just .stunnel is the directory. imap.conf is the file in that directory. And the contents of that file would be square bracket imap, close square bracket, client equals yes, accept equals 127.0.0.1.143, connect equals imap.gmail.com :993. Okay, so now you've got stunnel configured, you've got Elm configured insofar as it sees its own inbox as an IMAP inbox. So now you can start S-Tunnel with S-Tunnel space imap.conf. You've created an SSL tunnel and, or you've created a, well, let's just say you've created an SSL tunnel. And then you launch Elm. And now Elm detects that its inbox is not a local directory, but an IMAP folder somewhere out there on the internet. It goes out to that place and attempts to log in. It fails, but it does prompt you to log in. Now, if you've been literally using Gmail then you for the past who knows how many years, you may know, I think, by now that you can't do that. There's two-factor authentication, which is great. I mean, that's a good thing, but it's also a little bit awkward if you're not using anything, you know, if you're not using the Gmail interface, it gets a little bit complex. So for that, you do need to go into Gmail into your Gmail account. You need to set up basically a rescue code that they, or an application developer key, maybe is what they call it. I haven't done this in ages with Gmail, but you get basically a, you know, not a one-time password, but it's essentially, well, it's an API key, really. So it's a long string of numbers and letters that you'll never remember. You're not supposed to remember. Super, you know, random. And you put that in as your password, and it allows you then to skip the two-factor authentication. Elm, I think, caches all this. I haven't done this in a while with Elm. And so you only have to enter your credentials. I was going to say your creds, but then I thought, that sounds too casual. Your credentials once, I think, and then you're off and reading your email through Elm. And it's not a bad interface, to be honest. I mean, like Elm, I guess, you know, because of the name, Pine, Alpine, Elm, you kind of maybe associate it with that. But if I was going to associate it with anything, I would actually say it's tentatively, I want to kind of say it feels more like Mutt to me. Maybe that's mischaracterizing it, but I don't know. I guess Alpine has such a very specific kind of interface, whereas Elm, it takes over your terminal when you launch it. So it's an interactive client, and you can scroll through messages and read them. And I don't know, it's very sort of minimal, which I associate more with Mutt than Alpine. So it isn't a bad client. You might want to give it a try if you're looking for something like that. Just know, again, that it can be complex to set this up with modern email services, just because so many modern email services are really, really having to come up with interesting ways to deter intruders, which is a good thing. Like, you can't argue with that, but at the same time, it is a little bit tricky sometimes just to kind of configure it for yourself for everyday use. But then again, once you have it configured, it's pretty much set to go, like unless the email service changes something drastically. Next up is Epic. That's the enhanced programmable IRC client. So IRC is the Internet Relay Chat. It is a real-time chat protocol that is really very independent. It has been programmed and it is open source, and nobody owns IRC. That said, of course, as with any network service, there are servers out there that kind of have to host a place for people to connect. So, I guess I shouldn't say any internet service, because, I mean, there are things like GNU, GNU network stuff, GNU net, that doesn't require centralized services. But, everything eventually needs some kind of centralized service, right? But, I mean, it's not the same. So the network of IRC, when you have, some place hosting the relay, everyone can go through that to get messages. But it's not like, it isn't like Matrix or Mattermost or any of the chat services where there's a server and you chat and the chat messages get stored on that server until someone next happens to sign in and looks at their notifications and see that there's a message. Internet Relay Chat is like, it happens now and then it scrolls off the screen eventually. And that's the last you'll ever see of that message, more or less. I mean, people can log IRC. The IRC messages exist at some point, so people can take screenshots or log them or whatever. But generally, the way IRC works is that the chat is happening in real time, and when it scrolls off your screen, that's basically it. That chat message is gone. Again, not really, but basically. And that's both a strength and a weakness of the platform, I guess. I mean, the strength of it is that it's a great place to hang out, chat, learn new stuff, meet new people, that kind of thing. But the weakness is that if you're not there, then you're not there. Now, of course, that's also a strength, right? I mean, sometimes you don't want to be there. It's fine to not be somewhere. So maybe that's also a strength. It is that is the reason I have really kind of fallen out of the habit of using IRC personally. I used to be on IRC all the time, but that was largely enabled by the fact that I had a computer on all the time. And these days, while I do have a computer on most of the time, I don't quite have the same kind of workflow that I used to have, where I would be sitting at a computer pretty much all day, and then I would leave it on overnight and come back to the computer in the morning. And, if there were messages, I would see them in the window, in the chat window. Whereas these days, I mean, not only am I in a completely different time zone as everyone else, so my schedule doesn't really align to a lot of the people that I would be talking to anyway, but those chat messages just, they end up getting lost in the shuffle. And I've kind of switched over for chatting as such to Matrix, which is an open source network an open source chat network with lots of different clients that you could use. I mean, element.io is one of them, but there are others. The advantage to Matrix is that it is like a service. It's a cloud service, essentially. Things get cached, things get stored, you get notifications, you can go away for 7 days, 10 days, 30 days, come back, and you haven't really lost the chat. The chat is still there. It's scrolled up. You'll have to scroll up a lot, but it's still there. So that is, and it's got SSL and lots of kinds of identity verifications and things like that. So it's kind of a modern chat service, and you can do graphics and audio and video with it and so on. Well, I think it actually proxies audio and video through Jitsi, but you get the idea. It's a very sort of modern kind of chat, whereas IRC is text-based and very, I would say, ephemeral by design. IRC is also very, very simple. You can go to the RFC that defines IRC, which is something like RFC 1459, not something like it, it is it, and that's IRC. So if you're interested in IRC, one way to, you can certainly write your own client, but I mean, it is, I can't emphasize enough how simple IRC is. It is just, it's a data stream, and you can cat that data stream out to a terminal or something, and you see the packets or the packets, I guess, but what I'm trying to say is the headers. You see the header information, You see everything that it's defining, and then you can just parse that stuff and put it into a pretty client for yourself, and you've got an IRC client. I mean, you have to send stuff as well, and but you get a pretty quick idea of the traffic type just by reading the RFC. There's just not that much to it. It's kind of amazing, and it's a great place to start. Like, if you're starting with a programming language and you want to start branching out into network stuff, IRC is one of the easier protocols to kind of reverse engineer and engineer for, although fair warning, you may also get banned from places for spamming a channel by accident if you're doing testing and your testing is not correct. Speaking from experience. So, the epic idea, this extremely programmable IRC relay or whatever it's called, client, I guess, is that Epic deals with the protocols. It'll enhanced programmable IRC client. It'll deal with the protocols. It'll do the parsing for you. So in other words, it delivers to you a nice tidy package of here's the server that you've connected to. Here are the channels on that server. I think you can do basic IRC commands like joining a channel and things like that, I think. But what it really wants you to do then is to either write scripts for how Epic behaves, how you're going to interface with Epic, or just download someone else's scripts. And there's a fair number of scripts. I mean, if you look at the website of Epic, it kind of suggests, I feel like, there are just so many modules for Epic, and you're going to have this unbelievable wealth of choice of how you interface with Epic. And if you look into it a little bit closer, you know, today, it's more like, yeah, you've got like two. There's Amnesiac, which gives you a pretty sort of a, what I would consider a standard IRC interface, although that's not super fair to say that. I mean, what's a standard IRC interface? But I mean, for me, I guess it's kind of like IRSSI, and that's kind of like, for me, that's all I need. But there are fancier IRC interfaces out there, and I guess technically if you wanted to script something nicer for Epic, you could do so with the Epic scripting language, which is described on the website for the project, epicsol.org. That's where you can find out more about the scripting, or you can just download some of the Amnesiac scripts or the other set called Lice, L-I-C-E, those scripts. I think those give you a good idea of what the scripting language looks like. I guess maybe superficially I'd compare it to Perl, maybe. Looking at it, I'm not sure that I would feel comfortable trying to like learn it from the scripts. I think it would probably be better to read the docs. Either way, Epic is super, super flexible. I mean, it really, it gives you the engine, and then the front-end development is up to you. And while that seems really painful, if you're not looking to do that, it really seems like a inviting playground if you'd be up for that sort of thing. And the fact that, you know, these scripts already do exist, like Lice and Amnesiac, both of them, They do look quite appealing. Like Lice, for instance, even features notification features, if I'd known about that back when I was using IRC more often, I'd probably have downloaded and tried Lice along with Epic 5, because notifications is kind of one of the things that never really felt great about IRSSI, for instance. Like, there were some Perl scripts, I think, that could do some fancy things in IRSSI for notifications, but sometimes I just wanted assurance that, like, if my nick was mentioned, I wanted a thing on my screen, you know? I wanted a notification, a proper notification, and I never really quite got that down, I don't think. With KIRC, maybe? Is that the KDE one? KIRC? No. What is IRC for conversation. How could I forget that? With conversation, that helps a lot. Like, that'll give you everything. But then it's another GUI app, and that feels a little bit weird, maybe, if you're really into IRC. So, I don't know. IRC, I mean, it's a cool protocol, and I wouldn't take it away from anybody. That said, it just doesn't fit my workflow right now, and so I haven't been on IRC in, well, now, really, honestly, years. And I'm just looking to other open source chat options. Although, I mean, honestly, if I'm being completely honest, I'm a little fatigued of chat applications right now. I think I've probably said this on this show before, so I'll keep it quick, but I just can't believe we have regressed into a state where there are so many different chat networks and so many different chat clients. I remember back in the early 2000s when there was like ICQ and AIM and a bunch of others, and just, you know, Jabber and just a bunch of others, and I just thought, this is stupid, this is madness. And then it kind of all started to kind of filter down into, I don't know, I guess to my mind, it filtered down to IRC or Jabber. Like, those were the two, because Google was using Jabber for their GChat. So to my mind, that's what had happened. Like, IRC and XMPP, and we're settled. That's it. And I think there were still some holdouts on AIM, but not really. I mean, I'm saying all of this very dismissively because it's from my perspective. Like, for me, IRC and XMPP had just, they were it. That was it. That was the chat scene in the, let's say, 2010s. But then lately, it just seems like everything is splintered back out to a bunch of, you know, a full dozen different chat protocols that can't talk to each other very well, and nobody knows where anybody else is, and it's just the worst. It is so annoying to me, and at this point, I'm just kind of opting out, I think. Not consciously, it's just what I find is that at the end of the day, I very frequently realize, oh, I didn't launch any chat application today. Oops. Meant to. I guess I should have done that. And realistically, I just don't. I do use Signal some, because that's where a bunch of my family and other people are. So I do tend to be on that. And Element, or, you know, Element being the front end for Matrix, I do tend to have that open, even though I don't tend to, I shouldn't say tend, I sometimes have that open, and then I tend to ignore the notifications or miss them or whatever. So yeah, right now, me and chat I don't think we're aligned currently, which is fine. It's not a problem. Like, it's a great tool to have, just like Epic. Epic is a great tool to have if you're using IRC. Check that out. Next is ETH Tool. But, you know, before ETH Tool, we should really, honestly, grab a coffee. Back. I've got coffee from just the old Big Ben store. Big Ben. It's the place where I go for lots of dry goods. You bring your own container, you just fill it up and pay by weight. So I got some of their coffee. I can't even remember which one. Unite, maybe? Or Transcend or something like that? I don't know. It's something, you know, aspirational and emotive. So this is actually pretty good coffee. Like, it's not the coffee I would serve to guests to impress someone, but it's actually fine coffee. And having had Richard Harris recently, not as a guest, but as a coffee brand, I realized that this stuff is definitely better than the Richard Harris stuff, because drinking it doesn't make me sad about coffee. Whereas the Richard Harris stuff, I just, as you know, it just was so underwhelming, so bad. So this is pretty good. It's not as good as Flight by any means, and I have both in my cupboard now. So I've just kind of been switching back and forth, just kind of depending on which package I happened to reach in and grab first. And by no means would I say, I don't think I would confuse them, but they're, it's not, it's actually quite impressive. It's really good. So that's what I'm drinking. And before we get into ETH tool, which is a good command, and I'm excited to get into it, but before I do, let's talk about a little bit of listener feedback I received from Deep Geek. You know Deep Geek. He is a friend of mine who I've podcasted with before. It was him, me, and Lost in Bronx. We do a podcast together called Information Underground, and I'll include a link to the Gopher site where that's available. Yes, yes, it is just a Gopher site. We don't have an internet, we don't have a www, a World Wide Web presence. We have an internet presence. It's just not the protocol you might expect. Okay, so that's who Deep Geek is. That was just a stall tactic while I navigated to the email by Deep Geek. And he says, "Wanted to write that I am giving up on a project that I announced to you and that you discussed on your show, which was having a base system and using Flatpak and cheroots for most applications. Recently, I had an incident with Void Linux, which is not unusual for rolling release people, but for us, you as a Slackware devotee and me as a Debian devotee, would find odd, which is upgrading to a broken package. Void Linux's XBPS provides a snappy tool to downgrade to the latest, to the last working version, but since Debian people never have to downgrade, it was very weird for me. While I had this experience, I discovered Flatpak's dirty little secret. For every app you install, you convert that app into a rolling release schedule of updates. Eventually, I felt like updating my system was a part-time job. I've therefore decided to go back to Debian, customized to use Runit as an init system. I truly like Runit's syntax and configuration, and as it can run as a second init system, this future-proofs me against a potential future where I have to have systemd init running to use Linux. I've achieved the look of a different environment on different virtual desktops. While you can't run multiple window managers, multiple notification daemons, or multiple session managers, you can easily achieve the trappings of multiple environments with a window manager like Fluxbox or OpenBox that can be configured to open apps on specific virtual desktops. You then use a program called Xprop to get the name of different design elements and send them upon launching to a specific virtual desktop. I currently have Plank on one desktop, LXQt panel on another, and I even got Plasma desktop on a third, but I don't currently use this because Plasma is too heavy for my liking. In case you're thinking that the days of X11 are numbered, I'd like to mention that that a tech YouTuber named Brody Robertson has figured out how to use X Wayland in a quote-unquote rootful mode to run it as an X server on a display. So an X 11 window manager that is beloved can be run using X Wayland. I always like to close one of these long emails with a tech tip. I mean, this is Klaatu. He's already given several. Back to the email. So I wanted to mention XDG user dirs to people who hate .config directories polluting their home directory. It turns out that this already installed on most systems software allows you to move things like your desktop and downloads directory to an alternate directory. You then use an alias called something like gh for go home to get to these directories and leave your regular home directory behind with all your applications free to pollute it with .dot files and .dot directories to their heart's content. Okay, that's Klaatu now. So this is a great email. Lots of content here. First of all, let's just chat about Flatpak. Gotta talk about it. This is a tough one for me because I've got a lot of sort of thoughts about it, but I don't want to just take the whole episode talking about it. And anyway, what's the point? Like at the end of the day, Flatpak is Flatpak and it exists and it's a tool that we all have. So that's kind of where this ends up. But now let's go back to the start. So first of all, the rolling release thing. I'm not at all surprised that DeepGeek shies away in the end from a rolling release. Having come from Debian, I'm not surprised. I mean, Debian is Debian. I mean, it is famously slow moving. And that, depending on where you are in what you want from your computer, is a luxury to some, and, you know, a slog to others. And it really just depends on what you're looking for. And definitely, personally, I'm quite happy with a slow-moving system. I every 5 years, having to upgrade my system feels like just almost too much to ask. And that's Slackware. So I don't mind that personally, and DeepGeek apparently also doesn't mind. But I think in general I will. And so I should say that DeepGeek's experience with Flatpaks being sort of like a rolling release that he has to update all the time, I don't know where he's seeing that. I don't know where he, I don't know how he knows that he's updating Flatpak. This is not my experience, is the short version of this musing. When I install something with Flatpak on Slackware, it's just there for kind of forever, and I update it when I get around to it. Now, Signal, the chat application, is a notable exception. It alerts me in the application that this version of Signal is gonna stop support soon, and I have to update. So I go to the terminal and I do the Flatpak update, and then I struggle for 3 long minutes over how what the heck Signal is called to Flatpak, because it's not just Signal. You can't just type in Flatpak update Signal, because it's the Flatpak developers apparently are afraid that if they enable that kind of feature, then there will be suddenly a security flaw introduced. I don't know how that tracks, but that's their belief. And so they can't just alias something to Signal. You have to type in whatever.signalapp.signal, probably with maybe a capital S. Or maybe it's, I don't know, org.whispersystems.signal with a lowercase s. Or who knows? I don't know. I don't know what the thing is called. So you have to do a Flatpak list and then grep-i for case insensitive Signal to try to figure out what the heck you're updating, and then finally you update it. Okay, great. It only took 5 minutes out of my day. It only happens once every 6 months. Not that bad. So that's been my experience with Flatpak and sort of updating. I don't know what DeepGeek is seeing. I do have Flatpaks on my now Fedora laptop. It used to be a RHEL laptop, a Red Hat Enterprise Linux laptop, converted over to Fedora. I have Flatpaks there, and I guess maybe I'm updating it through the software center, whatever you call it, the GUI repo thing that Fedora uses now. But if I am, it must be invisible enough to me that I don't register it. So yeah, I don't feel, bottom line, I don't feel like I have that same experience as DeepGeek is seeing. And I'm wondering if part of his maybe annoyance with Flatpak from that perspective is simply that Void Linux has not integrated Flatpak as well as, for instance, Fedora. Or he's not as good at ignoring pending updates as I am on Slackware, for instance. So, I mean, I don't even know how I would find out on Slackware. Like, I have no alert system set up for Flatpak to scold me for not updating. It really would just be a manual process for me. I would have to launch, or I would have to interact with Flatpak on a terminal in order to get like a list of what's upgradable or updatable, and then I'd have to update and so on. I really update when I feel like I need to update, or when there's a release that has that claims to have fixed a bug that I have noticed, or a security bug that's obviously very important if it's like a network service or something. Okay, so that is the mystery of his annoyance. I don't understand that one, and I emailed him, and I didn't. I still don't understand what he's seeing. It's one of those things where I hear him, I believe him. I can't picture what it is exactly. And I feel like he and I might be having different experiences. Although we may be having the same experience, but the tolerance levels are different, which is entirely possible. Okay, so related to that, I think, there is, I think, the opportunity to really, really get weary of this kind of rush to always be upgrading in modern technology. Modern technology, I don't know whether it's just so broken or whether it's working so well that it's being attacked really, really well as well. but for whatever reason, it just seems like every single day, every week, you've got to upgrade something. If it's not the software, then it's the hardware. And if it's not the hardware, then it's the firmware. If it's not the firmware, then it's just the general aesthetic. You know, it's nonstop. Like, you always have to upgrade something. Like, there's never a time where you just buy a thing and then forget that it exists, or rather forget that it's a computerized device. And I think that's a real problem. We're down to like the real, real basics for purchasing things. Like maybe your USB headset. Maybe you bought that 3 years ago and haven't really thought about it since. Maybe this podcasting microphone I bought like a year ago, haven't really thought about it. You know, but I mean, it's just the little things at this point that you can get and you can get and forget. Everything else, it seems like there's always a pending update. Yeah, you know, whether you turn it on or turn it off, at some point there's some alert saying, well, stop what you're doing. We're going to update now. And it's just exhausting. And I wish there was a better way. And, you know, there is a better way. I mean, some things in your life can just auto update, and maybe they do. Right behind your back, you know, they just update. But I mean, on the other hand, there's a certain level of trust that sort of demands. I mean, like, would I want various things to auto update? Probably not, frankly. First of all, I want, you know, do I trust that device, the vendor of that device? Who's doing the update? What have they removed in this update? How have they broken a perfectly usable system in this update? So, you know, I don't think it's just, oh, well, there's more attacks on more devices than ever now. We just need to keep ahead of the security vulnerabilities. I think there's the issue of, I mean, that is, I think, an issue. There's just complexity, like bloated code that just has a lot of exploits that you can uncover within it, because things are just really messy. But I think the other thing is that we've gotten to a point where we're piling on so many things into, also, you know, like the Internet of Things, you know, like your light bulb connects to the internet or whatever, you know, your refrigerator connects to the internet, that kind of thing. Like the more we cram into devices, the more really you do have to update them, because yes, there is a weird exploit for your light bulb all of a sudden. But why would you ever have that in your light bulb, you know, that kind of thing. So I do think that minimalism, as it turns out, you know, which Deep Geek, I mean, that's one of his favorite things to talk about, is just minimal technical requirements. And I think probably minimal technical requirement is, you know, sort of minimal viable product, that's probably the solution to, like, oh my gosh, we have to upgrade everything today because of some reason. Like, well, if things were a lot simpler, I am imagining that things would require less maintenance, just because that's generally how it goes. Whether or not everyone would be happy with that is a different question. You know, heck, whether or not I would be happy with that is a different question. So, I mean, it's not really, because I've tested it, but it is. I mean, it's a question. So, that's my thoughts about that, I guess. And in general, as I've said, I think Flatpak, I think, is just kind of, in my mind, it's a nice extras repository. It's one of those things where it's an order of operations. If you tell me to install an application, I'm going to absolutely, initially, first stop will be slackbuilds.org. Well, actually, my first stop will be Slackware. Does it have it already on the computer? Because that happens. I mean, I keep going back to Acadian Live. Like, who would have ever thought I would just have a video editor on my Slackware system? Well, 15.0 ships with Acadian Live. I mean, it's just there, and it's great. It's amazing. So there is that. So the next step would be slackbuilds.org, the official unofficial repository for Slackware. And then after that, might be just going to a project website and seeing if they have a download, you know, kind of doing that kind of thing. But eventually, like all other options failing, then Flatpak is a nice thing to have available. It's there. You can install stuff with it, and the thing will probably work. I think that's nice for the user. I also, as I've said in the past, I think it's nice for a developer. Developers don't necessarily want to think about the platform. They don't want to have to become Linux fans. They don't want to have to champion Linux as an operating system. It's just, they just want to deliver it to people who want their software. And if Flatpak is a single target for those developers that all Linux users are able to use, all being, you know, most. I mean, there are exceptions to everything, but I mean, largely anybody using Linux could use a Flatpak. So, I mean, I think that's a brilliant, brilliant solution. Is Flatpak better than, say, AppImage? Depends on probably who you're talking about. Like, for a user, I think AppImage does seem a little bit nicer, but for the developers, I think Flatpak is by far the better experience. It's just a question of Flatpak having all of these, what they call the SDKs, where they have all of this, all of these libraries and things are already bundled up and put into the Flatpak sort of subsystem. And so as a developer, all you have to do is package up your application and maybe another, you know, some other library that you that you know isn't in an existing SDK. But as long as you're kind of writing for Linux, chances are one of the Flatpak SDKs are going to have what you were programming against. And so you don't have to worry about them. AppImage, you have to put everything into your AppImage, like everything. I was trying to package something that needed Python up for an AppImage, and I asked how to do it. And the AppImage team literally told me to just bundle up Python. I just thought, nope, not going to do that. I am not going to include Python in my little tiny Python script or my little tiny Python application. I'm not going to include Python itself so that this runs on people's systems. Just that just seems a little bit silly to me. So it's just, you know, but to the user, you know, certainly, yeah, download this file, click it, launch it, it and it works. You don't have to worry about Flatpak. You don't have to worry about SDKs. You didn't just install a gigabyte of GNOME libs just so that this little widget will work on your system. You know, I mean, I see there are advantages to something like AppImage. So those are my thoughts, I think, on Flatpak and I guess AppImage. I can't talk about one without the other. Okay, and finally, let's talk about ethtool. Ethtool is a command to analyze your Ethernet device, your Ethernet interface card. So to use ethtool, you might have to use sudo to launch it because it is not generally available. But if you do sudo ethtool and then eth0, for instance, if you have an eth0 interface, you get all the information about that interface device. If you don't have eth0, then do ipas, so ip space a space s. That's short for IP, that's the command, A for adder, A-D-D-R, or for address. I guess you could do that too, IP space address space show. Sudo, I have to do it with sudo. There's IP, there's eth0, so yours might be, you know, whatever the other one is. What is it, ENPS01 or something like that. Or you might not be using Ethernet, you might be using WLAN0, so that wouldn't really do a whole lot for you with ethtool. So, but if you're using Ethernet, then eth0 or ENPS01 or whatever the new notation is, that's your Ethernet interface. And you can do sudo ethtool that interface. So in my case, it is eth0. And you get a report on how on what your system knows about your Ethernet card. And this is and the way that it is communicating with your network. So In this case, you got settings for ETH, or in my case, I've got settings for ETH 0, supported ports, TP and MII, supported link modes, 10 base T, 100 base T, 1000 base T, 2500 base T. Well, that's cool. So those are the link modes. That's the speed, essentially, the possible, the supported speeds of your Ethernet device. So I could go 10 base T, 100 base T, 1000 base T, that's like 1 gigabit per second, 2500, that's 2.5 gigabits per second. That's not bad. So that's a lot of potential speed. And if I continue going through this list, eventually I get down to this one thing that says speed 1000 megabits per second. So that's 1 gigabit per second. And that seems not as fast as it could be, right? I got 1000, but it clearly says right here that the supported link mode includes the upper limit of 2500 base T full. So why wouldn't I just use that? Well, there are reasons. But you could, if you wanted to, you could set your Ethernet device to use a different speed with ETHTool. ETHTool, that's what its job is. It's a direct connection, sort of, or direct control over your Ethernet device. Now, you kind of have to be careful when you're doing this. This isn't something that you get to just do whatever you want. This is a command that's interfacing with a driver that's interfacing with your card. What driver specifically is being talked to in this case? Well, it depends entirely on your system. So if you do an ETHTool or a sudo ETHTool dash I or dash dash driver and then ETH zero or whatever your Ethernet card is named on your system, then you get exactly which driver you're using. So in my case, it's driver R8169 version 5.15.38, firmware version RTL8125B-2_0.0.2-07-1320, and a lot more information besides. So that's the driver in use, and the card is, I've got all the specifications for the card from just ETHTool ETH0, but there's another component here. And in my case, I've got my computer hooked up to a router, and that router hooked up in turn to the modem thing, or whatever it's called, the thing from the fiber company. I don't know what that actually is called now that I'm thinking about it, but that box there from the fiber company, that's sending the internet to my router, which in turn is sending the internet to the house. Okay, so networks. Every single time, and if I'm getting one thing conveyed in this podcast series during the in section of Slackware, it is that when you are dealing with network configuration, you're always dealing with at least two different things. One is your computer, and then the other is your network, the network. So you can do whatever you want on your computer, but if your network doesn't know about it, then in many cases, when it's a network configuration, it's still just on your computer. And so that was true for bind. It was true for DNS mask. It's true for DHCP. It's true for something like ETHTool. So I can certainly just change my speed of my Ether. Don't try this at home if your connection is critical, because this could potentially break your connection. Sudo ETHTool dash dash change, pretty straightforward, ETH zero, that's the interface, speed 2500, because again, that's the upper limit of my speed is 2500, so why not? And then we'll do it in duplex, we'll do full, and then we're gonna set auto negotiation, or auto neg, AUTONEG. It sounds like something negative, but it's actually negotiation, auto negotiation to off. And you have to set that to off because right now it's on. If you look at the output of ETH0 or of ETHpool ETH0, you'll even see it somewhere here, I think. Maybe you won't. Maybe you won't see it. No, here it is. Link partner advertised auto negotiate. That's not it. Advertised auto negotiation. Yes. Well, anyway, auto negotiation is basically a communication between your Ethernet device and the thing it is connected to. And they kind of talk to each other and tell each other what they're capable of. And that's the important thing. In this case, I'm set to 1,000. My speed is set to 1,000 megabits per second because I have auto negotiation turned on. Now, following the logic here, if the device I'm connected to were capable of 2,500 megabits per second or 2.5 gigabits per second, then through auto negotiation, my device should be set to that, and it isn't. But let's pretend like I don't care. So I'm going to turn auto negotiation off and hit return, and you'll even see it like in your desktop, like my network manager just sent me an alert saying that I'm no longer connected. Or actually it says that I am limited. I have limited connectivity is the exact error that it says. So I can mess around with this all I want. I can turn it back on to like 1,500 maybe. Can I get a little bit of an improve? No. Yeah. I'm not connected until I go back down to 1,000. And then at that point, honestly, I may as well just turn auto negotiation back on because apparently auto negotiation knew what it was doing. But that's how you would do that. So you can go in and change the settings of your Ethernet card with ETHtool. And you can get a lot of information too. And that's kind of probably maybe more useful than anything. I mean, unless you're just testing things, or you know something that your network card doesn't. Generally, I think I would imagine more often than not, it's going to be more like, oh, let's look at what I'm getting from this device, and you can find out some of that through ETHtool. There's a man page. You can read the man page. There's a bunch of stuff that you can manipulate: your MAC address, the speed, obviously, the activity, really, like what kind of activity are you permitting on that device? Generally speaking, though, again, generally speaking, there's no expectation that it would be required for you to use ETHtool for anything, really. I mean, your Ethernet card should just work. So this is definitely, I feel like, more like a troubleshooting tool or maybe a hacking tool where you're really just trying to get to know your Ethernet card, see what it's capable of, maybe do some interesting things with it. It is not meant as like a necessary step. Oh, did you run ETHtool? Otherwise, you know, naturally you wouldn't be on the internet. That shouldn't be a thing that you hear. Let's see. There's also in ETHtool, I remember there being, oh yeah, flashing firmware. That's vaguely, I could believe that you'd have to drop the ETHtool to do that sometime. Maybe there's like a firmware update for your Ethernet card. I mean, a lot of those kinds of updates, you know, you're behind a firewall probably anyway, so maybe you wouldn't need to do that. But what if you're talking about a gateway system that maybe isn't behind the firewall? Maybe you do need to update that firmware because maybe there's some kind of bad code in the thing that got shipped. Something like that. So that's a believable use case. Although, you know, that said, I've never had to do it. So it's a really cool command, ETHtool. Check it out, man, ETHtool. And I believe with that, unless I'm mistaken, I think that's the end of the E's. Yeah, that is. The next one after this is fetch mail, and that's the only F. So then we'll be into the G's. I feel like progress. We can really see the progress in the N folder. That it's kind of nice sometimes when that happens. You know, when you actually see letters go by and you're not stuck in just L in the L's forever. So I do consider it a little bit of a luxury to be in the cozy little network directory with all these applications that have a reasonable number of applications per letter. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
Of his fame and good fortune, the earth begins to tremble.